From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. A crossroads of constitutional law for the executive, legislative, and judicial branches.
I sometimes refer to it as a game of rock, paper, scissors. Each one is equally powerful and can serve as a check on the other.
This hour, Professor Barb McQuaid joins us to talk about the precedents impeachment may set. In other news, Governor Gretchen Whitmer delivers her State of the State address tonight. We'll address where she stands at the beginning of her second year in office. Also, Leah Vernon on modeling in hijab.
I want it to be a conversation piece. When people look at me, I want them to be like, oh my God, like who is she and what does she have on and what is the inspiration behind it?
Her new memoir is called Unashamed, Musings of a Fat Black Muslim. She'll talk to us about Instagram stardom, visibility, and more. All that's coming up on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On the show today, a former U.S. attorney from Michigan deconstructs the game of three-dimensional chess playing out in the Senate impeachment proceedings. Barb McQuaid says there's an important struggle going on over the limits of executive power. We'll talk with her later this hour. But first, tonight's the night. Governor Gretchen Whitmer is to deliver her second State of the State address this evening. It was a challenging first year between a budget standoff with the legislature, a host of environmental and legal issues to deal with, and more. Michigan Radio's live coverage tonight at 7 will be hosted by our own senior producer, Laura Weber-Davis, and Capitol Bureau Chief Rick Pluta. And they're with us now from Lansing with a preview. Laura, Rick, how are you?
Hey.
Hello.
I was thinking, tonight's the night. I hate to make light of the situation, but I have to say, this is kind of one of the most exciting nights of the year at the state capitol, I think.
Mm-hmm. Maybe the most exciting night.
I am all for theme songs for every State of the State address in Michigan in perpetuity from now on. You know, Gretchen Whitmer's path to office was powered in part by a now famous promise stated in five words, to fix the damn roads. Here we are, one year in, and the comprehensive fix that she promised has not quite materialized. Can we recap what happened with road funding in 2019? Rick, you want to start us off?
Sure. The governor gave her proposal, and it was a 45-cent per gallon increase. Am I getting that number right, Laura?
45 cents, yeah.
Yeah, 45-cent per gallon increase, which was pretty much DOA. The Republicans said no way, and that set off a series of political machinations that the governor took some controversial budget maneuvers, some of which alienated her own base. And so long story short, that she and the Republican leaders, after getting themselves into this corner, had to back out of it. And now they're back to the starting point.
one year later, to try and
fix the damn road.
Yeah, well, you know, I think it's just one of those things where 45 cents a gallon, I think, was a tough pill to swallow for just about anybody who heard it. I mean, as a person who's driving on the roads every day, as a politician, as a lobbyist, 45 cents a gallon seemed like a very clear-cut, if not simplistic, way to tackle a very large problem. And the price tag alone was just going to be too overwhelming.
Yeah, even Democratic leaders said that was not going to happen.
Be feasible.
And the governor stood by it. And, you know, thus we wound up at a budget impasse.
Laura, what are some of the options that Gretchen Whitmer might discuss tonight as she revisits the issue?
You know, I mean, all I've been following are the same things that you've probably been following, April. The idea of toll roads, at least a study into whether toll roads are feasible and whether they would collect the right amount of money and how long it would take to collect that money. There's a bonding issue out there of whether or not we can essentially borrow the money, mm-hmm. pay back later.
And the benefit of that for the governor is that within some parameters, she could do that without getting the legislature's approval. And we're already seeing the legislative Republicans gearing up to make a fight out of that.
But the only thing that I can see that seems really clear-cut, April, is that regardless of whether or not they are able to establish a plan that works for everybody, at least in part, this year, which even that seems unlikely, the roads won't be fixed in the way that we'd like to see them within the next 3 years. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be revisiting this conversation at least every year for Gretchen Whitmer's first term, if she has mm-hmm. another one.
Well, remember, the last governor, Republican Rick Snyder, wanted to do something about the roads and never got
right.
Near what he said was necessary. And he was a Republican working with Republicans right. in the legislature.
I wonder what the state's credit rating looks like right now. I'm sure just borrowing sounds like a pretty tempting idea at this point.
Well, borrowing typically is tempting up front, but the problem is eventually you have to start paying it back. And Michigan is still paying back from previous of borrowing for roads and infrastructure. And a lot of especially conservative Republicans are more interested in a pay-as-you-go route. However, they're more interested in the going than the paying.
Is there motivation, do you guys think, for Republicans in the opposition to collaborate with Whitmer on a road fix, if only to avoid another budget deadlock?
I would say yes, because there is general agreement that there are problems with the roads. But I there are two things, is that Republicans and the governor have not agreed on the size of the problem, and so therefore they have not agreed on how much money is needed and where it would come from. And there is now a new elephant in the room, and it's tied to the State of the Union address that Governor Whitmer is going to be delivering the English language Democratic response. And that suddenly, as her national profile is on the rise, that also means that there is diminished interest, at least in some elements of the Republican coalition, to hand her the sorts of victories that would contribute to that.
Published reports have also suggested that Governor Whitmer tonight is going to address a topic that traditionally has not been a part of state policy speeches, and that's workplace harassment. No doubt this has been informed by three women's recent statements that State Senator Pete Lucido said or did inappropriate things to them. I mean, does the governor have any power over this situation? It would be for the legislative caucus to administer any punishment if the allegations are found to have merit, right?
Well, I think it depends on how you quantify power, because she's in a very unique position to speak about it. And I think the power of her words might be enough to resonate throughout the Capitol. She is
the moral authority.
Yeah. She is a woman who has experienced sexual harassment in this very workplace before.
I mean, she's been in Lansing for almost 20 years now, hasn't she, Laura?
Exactly. Yeah. Yep. She's had kids while she's been there. She started very young. Rick, you might not remember off the top of your head. She was like in her 20s.
She wasn't in her 20s.
Yeah. She's been around for a while. Yeah. And she's part of a political family. She's got a long history here. And she, she has experienced sexual harassment as well. And so I think that being able to talk about it from a first person perspective is going to make the issue feel that much heavier and weightier. And while she might not be able to just unilaterally sign something that says, you guys have to do X, Y, and Z to clean this issue up, just drawing attention to it is going to juxtapose her against her male counterparts in a way that will make them maybe have to act in some way that changes things.
And it is powerful when a governor, especially a female governor in this instance, can simply declare times have changed, learn from it.
Yeah. Various news sources have been dribbling out little other hints about topics that Governor Whitmer might address tonight, a task force for drug prices, some patient protections regarding pre-existing conditions, an expansion of Michigan's free preschool, and maybe some action on maternal mortality issues. Mm-hmm. I mean, when we look at all this in concert with other issues that she's focused on, who is Gretchen Whitmer aiming at with an agenda that looks like this?
I would say working families. I think these are issues that everybody thinks about, especially when they have kids. Maternal mortality, universal pre-K, these are things that people think about, especially when it starts to affect their pocketbook. And they're looking, especially when they're looking at their pocketbook and they're thinking, I can't believe how much I'm paying for preschool. And then there are many people who can't afford it. Those people who can't afford preschool do have options in front of them. But I think that the issue is attractive enough that it affects a broad swath of the population. So you're basically talking about every working class family in the state of Michigan.
I think there's a case that she's trying to make here, at least it would appear this way, that Michigan's capacity to generate the revenue for the services that people expect has not kept up. And so people want these services, but they need to pay the taxes to do that. And so just like she did last year, she will probably in a narrower sense, try to make the case still that at some point, if we expect these services, then we have to generate the revenue to pay for them. And whether it's through a gas tax or doing something with the income tax or some other, you know, source of revenue, that you know, she's going to slowly and subtly start to make, you know, continue to make the case for that.
And, you know, April, I'll just say that, you know, if you look at these issues that you listed, if you're talking about drug prices, preschool, maternal mortality, nobody wants to, everybody is confronted with these issues, mortality, illness, children. These are things that tend to come up in all of our lives, and at least the majority of us. And so I think tackling those issues in the speech might be smart for her when she has had some unpopular moments in her first year.
Mm-hmm. State of the State addresses tend to be one part to-do list, one part rallying cry. Sometimes politicians use it to sort of poke back at their critics. What does Gretchen Whitmer need this speech to do?
Well, I think one of the things are you're absolutely right, but you know, we talked about this earlier, that the national role that she is going to be taking as the Democratic response to President Trump's State of the Union address means that whether she likes it or not, or whether others like it or not, that she will be using this to set the stage for that. So everything that she says in this, or at least most of the things that she says in this, are also going to be a prelude to that, that she's going to be delivering an expected Democratic rallying cry that's an alternative to what we're seeing happening in Washington right now.
You know, Gretchen Whitmer is personable, and she is smart, and she is charismatic, and she needs a speech to continue that message for her both nationally and in order to move her own agenda forward in the legislature, I think, by getting the public behind her.
Stateside Senior Producer Laura Weber Davis and Capitol Bureau Chief Rick Pluta. Guys, thank you.
Hey, thanks.
Pleasure.
They'll be anchoring our live coverage of the second State of the State address by Gretchen Whitmer this evening, beginning at 7 p.m. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We like to believe that the internet has something for everyone, for better and for worse. The constraints and hang-ups of the real world should melt away as we come together online and find our community. Growing up in Detroit, model and style blogger Leah Vernon found nothing reflecting her experience. Last year, she published a memoir called Unashamed, Musings of a Fat Black Muslim. It's a story about how she learned to override people's expectations and find her path to Instagram stardom. We spoke with her earlier this year. Leah Vernon, welcome to Stateside.
Hey, thank you for having me. I'm excited. A little scared.
There is nothing for the unashamed woman to be afraid of here. You start the book by saying, "Where I come from, women hide things."
Yes.
Why is that important to understand?
I think that's important to understand because a lot of my life, just personally, I have hidden things. Especially, there's a part in the book about my secret abortion at 19. And I had that for at least a good decade before I actually started talking about it openly. And the fact that was like eating me up inside, where I felt like I couldn't tell anyone, where I couldn't be unashamed about my decision. When I was finally able to say it out loud, so much weight was like released from me. And so I think it's important for people to be able to share their truths and not be ashamed about it, not hide it, because it's just so much weight to carry when we hide things. And I know a lot of marginalized women and individuals, we hide so much.
There have been a couple of memoirs that have addressed this lately. I was thinking of Kiese Layman's Heavy, where, you know, what is on one hand a contemplation of exteriors is very much an exploration of interiors. It must have been a very daunting subject to approach in writing.
Yeah, it's really interesting because like I never set out to be a memoirist, or I never set out to have my life broadcasted on the internet or in a book. I started out as a fiction writer. I always wrote like YA dystopian and like multicultural sci-fi, where I could kind of like live vicariously through these characters who were open and strong and all these things, something I can never do in real life. And so it's really interesting how I kind of shared something small on the internet when I first started blogging, and people were like, oh my God, we want to know more. And it just kind of snowballed into me giving a little bit more and being more comfortable, having other women who look nothing like me, believe nothing in what I do, be like, hey, like, I'm not a fat Black Muslim woman, but I have had an abortion, or I've went through a divorce, or I went through a messy period. And it's so amazing how like universal storytelling and narrative have become.
You paint evocative pictures of growing up in Detroit in the book. That's sort of the first few chapters. And you talk about how you and your brothers and sisters were brought up, and you were homeschooled and brought up Muslim, of course. Your early childhood sounds strict and riddled by, you know, problems that your mom was having with the men in her life, but also very fun in some ways.
Yes.
Can you talk about what you remember from those years and what it was like writing about them?
I think a lot of times, especially like with me talking about like my childhood and stuff like that, some people have been very aggressive with some of the reviews about my mother. And just for the record, like, my mother did the best she could with what she had. It wasn't easy raising all the children she had with no help from any of the fathers. And it was hard writing some of the moments, because as an adult, you really are like, sometimes we forget the things that kind of shape us. And so me having to recall some of the stories about like my father like fat shaming me, or just other situations where I felt were inappropriate, it hurt. I cried a lot writing these essays. But on the other end, it was definitely a relief to finally put them out on paper.
Well, those obstacles are a big part of the early part of your growing up story that you tell in the book. You were raised Muslim, of course. Your mom's Muslim and raised all the kids that way. Could you tell us what Islam meant to you when you were, say, a teenager?
I think that I definitely, as a teenager, it went back and forth with it. I felt like initially I was very excited to wear the hijab. I was very excited to, you know, be seen in the world as a Muslim, as a visible Muslim woman. And then the teenage years hit, where you're just like, what's cool? What's in? I want to kind of conform like everybody else. I want to be a thin, you know, white girl with both her parents. And, you know, I want to fit into the societal norm, right? And so that really tore me up inside, where it was just like, you can't really be who you want to be being visibly fat, being visibly Black, and being visibly Muslim. So how can we kind of hide these things and not really talk about it? I was ashamed, honestly, to even say I was Muslim. And I wanted to take my hijab off many times, but I felt like I was not necessarily forced, but it would be an issue if I decided to take it off. And so you'll see, like, definitely in the essays, the evolution of me kind of fighting against the hijab and loving it, and then fighting against it, and then loving it, and not really understanding what it's about. But then that journey of identity, which we all can identify with.
There were so many difficult passages in and out of those essay chapters, talking about, you know, your struggles to get into college and to make it through college alongside kids who had money and resources, and you're figuring out your own identity as a woman, as a Muslim, and as a Black woman. What would you say kept you going during those years?
I constantly ask myself that, honestly. I always ask myself, why you and not someone else who grew up in the same exact community or environment? Why you? And I kind of go back and forth with multiple responses, some of which is, I don't know. Some of which are, I always had this drive to do more, to do something bigger and greater. And I remember always telling people, like, I think I'm going to do something amazing one day. I'm not sure what it is. It will probably be with stories, but I don't know if that's possible because of the way I look or because of the way I sound. And so I always had that internal fire and drive, in which I still carry to this day, and which I also tell baby Leah V, that I appreciate you for having that despite the odds, despite the Muslim community telling you that you can't model because that's not becoming of a Muslim woman, despite your white coworkers telling you that, or the microaggressions that they show you because you are the only black manager in this field. You know, so I always had that drive, and I'm glad that I continued it. And also, I don't know, I take opportunities as they come. Although I'm a very scary person beyond popular belief, I still make the time to be like, you know what, on the other side of fear is greatness. And whatever happens, at least you could say you tried.
The phenomenon that people on Instagram know as Leah V began as your marriage was ending and you decided to take this flyer on a modeling career because people were always complimenting you on your style. But how did that really go from being an idea to something that you were able to make happen?
I think, honestly, at this point, people like to hate on the social medias, and I understand that there's definitely some messed up things happening on social media right now and just media in general.
Oh, yes.
But I would not be where I am right now without Instagram. Instagram has given me a platform and a voice in which I never would have had without it. And so I always tell people everything can be good or bad, but it's what you make of it. And so I had a Facebook. I was so anti-social media at the time. My friends were like, you need to get an Instagram. And I'm just like, I don't have time for any more than Facebook. I'm in school. I go to work. I don't have time for these social medias. And they were like, girl, it's so much drama on there. I'm like, drama? I like a little mess. And so I basically made an Instagram page, and I stumbled upon hashtags. And one of them was plus size model. And I'm just like, oh my God, she has big boobs, big hips, living her best life, getting flown out. They are beautiful. They are thriving. And I've never seen that before. And I'm like, I can do this too. And it went from the idea of seeing other fat, curvy, plus size, whatever you want to call them, women and individuals in the industry thriving. And I'm just like, there are no fat black Muslims in the game. So let me just use my grainy Android phone, start posting pictures. And people were like, oh my God, I've never seen this before. Like, I've not. And we went and just blew up from there.
Will you tell us a little bit about the evolution of your looks?
Oh, Lord.
I mean, were you probably doing a lot of your own styling in the early stages.
I was. No, I still do a lot of my. People think that I have like this whole team behind me, and I have all these people just at my, you know, beck and call. And it's like I do a lot of stuff alone and by myself, and it still looks like, you know, Vogue magazine level. But yeah, I definitely style myself still, and because I have a very distinct style, I like boldness, color, neons, all of that, and so it's definitely evolved. I actually won't let anyone use any photos before 2016-17-ish because I definitely had my choices of styles, and I wouldn't necessarily condone them right now. But I definitely give, you know, younger Leah V a pat on the back for making for being brave in those choices.
Your portfolio of hijab is just nothing short of stunning, both in terms of color and variety. How do you approach what you're going to do with each different thing that you're wearing?
Well, I draw inspiration from drag queens. I really, really love them, all of them. And just the fact that they have the feathers and the sequins and the contour and all the glam that comes with it. I'm in love with drag queens. And so I would be like, okay, this drag queen had this cut crease or this sequins gown. I need to like do something like this. But in my own, you know, Leah V it, and so make it like, you know, my own style. But I definitely take inspirations from art and different eras, like the Victorian era, or I'll take some African print and like add that to something. But all the clothes or styles that I do have to make me feel like I am a queen. Like, I need to feel as if a millennial queen will wear something like this. I want it to feel regal, and just like, I want it to be a conversation piece. When people look at me, I want them to be like, oh my God, like, who is she and what does she have on, and what is the inspiration behind it?
I thought one of the most fabulous essays in the book was your essay on dating and coming to dating as a full-grown adult post-divorce, like that was really the first time you were out there playing the field. It was just, it was really, the way you wrote about it was very funny and very frank, but at the same time, just, you know, I could feel you feeling your own power. What was the biggest surprise to you when you got back out there?
Dating. It's a situation.
An ongoing situation.
It's always never ending. And it's really interesting. And I think a lot of listeners will probably agree with this. But when you go from whether you've been married for someone to a minute and or had a long-term partnership with someone and you just don't have that person anymore, it's like, wow, what do I do here? And I feel like I went through a good 6 months of straight messiness, because like, remember, I got married at 19 and I got divorced like 28, 29-ish, and so that's like a whole decade. And to go from, you know, little baby to like now I'm grown and I have like a business, to now I am trying to fill a void with men, and that's what I did. And I definitely added that in the book, because I think that people need to understand that you're definitely you're broken once you get divorced from and you're in a long-term situation. And I was, and I was searching for individuals to fill a void that they were never going to possibly fill. And so I actually, after, you know, being messy, being in these streets for a couple of months, I'm like, this is not you and this is not helping. So you probably need to calm down and stop everything and focus on healing. And so I've actually not really dated a lot now. I'm just focusing on my work. Recently, I actually did go on one little date, and my friends were like, oh my God, Leah, you went on an actual date? I'm like, I know. Are you proud of me? Because like, people know I don't date. And it's very interesting now that there's a lot of different dynamics with me dating and me being a Muslim and dating. And people are like, oh, I don't think I should talk to you because you're Muslim. I'm like, no, I'm a human being. I still want to date people. And it's just, it's a very interesting dynamic being a plus size Muslim social media influencer who is dating. It's very interesting. I need to have like a book just about that alone.
So this book published in 2019, and it was really an amazing year in a lot of ways. 2019 was also the year that the world figured out the divinity of Lizzo.
Oh, yeah.
And it was also the same year that a show based on Lindy West's memoir, Notes from a Fat Woman, hit Hulu. Mm-hmm. And it's the same year that Rashida Tlaib got sworn into Congress.
Yeah.
What would you like for 2020?
Well, it's, how can we top that? Like, how can we possibly top all of those amazing baddies? And yeah, I think that what I would want to see, because I do a lot of back end work, and I'm on set with like sometimes straight size, a lot of straight size people, and it's sometimes you'll see the front end being inclusive, but not necessarily the back end. So I would want to see more back end inclusion. So more like photographers, more stylists, more marketing people, not just having a token on the set and then everyone else on, you know, behind the scenes is white making decisions about inclusion. And so I would love to see more of that. I would love to see more marginalized bodies, whether that means queer, whether that means Muslim, dark skin, whether that means you are in a wheelchair or you use assistive devices. I want to see more of that in mainstream commercials and high fashion and beauty. We've seen some of it now, but there can be so much more. Like, for instance, I went on the casting call for a well-known beauty company. I wasn't chosen, but in the room of 30 girls, I was the only Muslim, the only fat girl, and the only like black girl. And I was like, okay, so this is how we're doing things. And so
the concern is they checked all the boxes with one person.
Yeah, but they didn't end up like hiring me. So it's like, you guys are I see you guys going in the right direction, but are we really, really going all the way and really showing that, you know, we want to be inclusive as a company in the front and in the back end of the business? And so I'd love to see more voices put on pedestals, more voices just in front, like as the main. Not just like, oh, I'm a sidekick. Like, no, I want to see like the main faces of marginalized individuals.
So, Leah Vernon, what's next?
Well, right now we are looking into doing more events and tours next year, beginning in January, hopefully. I'm looking to do more modeling gigs, more like high level magazine things. I am trying to get signed to an international agency, and It has some other big projects coming up, but I don't think I'm at liberty to say right now about that. But it's going to be really huge. I think people are going to be like, oh, my God, like, I am dead. And the last thing is that I'm working on book number two.
Oh, awesome.
And it probably won't be a memoir.
Are we going to get your science fiction book finally?
I think so. Yeah, I'm working on it. And so I'm a little scared. People are going to be like, oh, this is way off. But I'm like, I was writing this before, guys. So I am working on that now. I think it's a great story, and I think that people are going to really, it's going to resonate with people.
That's awesome. This book that's on shelves right now is Unashamed, Musings of a Fat Black Muslim. The author is Leah Vernon. You can find her on Instagram as LVernon2000, Leah V. Leah Vernon, thank you so much for the book and for your beautiful feed. It's just, it's gorgeous.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. History may remember 2020 for many things, but the impeachment proceedings playing out in the U.S. Senate are part of an ongoing conversation about the American experiment and how its three-legged structure of government can survive. Professor Barbara McQuaid is a former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan, now with the University of Michigan's Law School. She published an essay this week in the academic journalism website The Conversation, arguing for this as an important moment in questions of executive power. Barb McQuaid, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks, April. Glad to be here.
You point out that one of the main outstanding questions in the extent of executive is the extent of executive privilege. Don McGahn, former White House counsel to the president, has declined to obey a subpoena in the House impeachment proceedings and appealed the judge's order to comply. What could the resolution of his case tell us?
Yeah, April, you know, you used an interesting phrase there when you said that our government is a three-legged stool. I sometimes refer to it as a game of rock, paper, scissors. You know, each one is equally powerful and can serve as a check on the other. And with regard to executive privilege, that is a way for the executive branch to say to Congress, we're going to stop your oversight ability by playing this card, by using executive privilege. And it is a recognized doctrine. It plays an important role. It allows a president to say, I want to encourage frank and candid conversations with my highest level aides without the chilling effect that might exist if they knew that their conversations could one day become public. And that has value, and we want to protect that. But in the past, in the case of United States versus Nixon, the Supreme Court said this is not spelled out in the Constitution. It's kind of a court-made construct, but it does have value. We recognize it, but it has some limitations. What President Trump has done with regard to Don McGahn and others is to say, not only do I have executive privilege, but I have something called absolute immunity. And that means that my close aides don't even have to show up when Congress serves them with a subpoena. And so he has taken executive privilege and really ramped it up a notch. That challenge, that Congress has challenged that. Some committees have brought legal suits challenging that assertion of executive privilege. And in particular, this case involving Don McGahn, a district court judge has decided that there is no such thing as absolute immunity. You have to show up and at least answer questions subject to a question-by-question basis before you can assert executive privilege. And I think we're going to see in the coming months in the courts of appeals and maybe at the Supreme Court what the contours of that may be. So through this litigation, I think we're going to get some answers to some questions about the limits of executive privilege.
U.S. courts have functioned under something called political doctrine. And as you point out, the judiciary does not want to referee every single dispute between the executive branch and Congress. But there is at least some room for discussion about whether the courts can wade into impeachment matters when there's a question of fairness. If the Trump defense team wanted to go there, what would the president's attorneys have to prove to a court to show that the Senate's proceedings have been unfair?
This is another area where I think we're in uncharted waters. As you mentioned, there is this doctrine known as the political question doctrine, which says that courts should not wade into issues that are best left to the political branches, meaning the executive branch and the legislative branch. Courts are there to decide legal questions. They call it justiciability, and not to decide political questions. They shouldn't decide matters of policy. They shouldn't decide whether we should be allies with Ukraine or we should have different foreign policy. And so in some of the questions that come up in the impeachment context, for example, there's a case involving a judge named, ironically enough, Nixon. Walter Nixon. This causes some confusion from time to time because there's so little case law on impeachment, and two of them are named Nixon. But in a case involving a judge, Walter Nixon, he was impeached and removed from office.
Yeah, people sometimes forget federal judges can be removed from the bench if they are impeached.
Right. And that, you know, it's not just the president. It is government officials, including judges. And there was a judge, Walter Nixon, in the 1980s who was removed from office. He filed a lawsuit trying to essentially appeal his removal from office, the decision of the Senate to remove him from office. He appealed that. And in that case, the court said, no, this is a political question. The Constitution gives the sole power of removal from office upon impeachment to the Senate. And so it would be improper for us to look into that. Now, they did leave just a little bit of wiggle room in that case that said that in a case of gross violations of due process, maybe that would be another matter. But in terms of just the wisdom of the decision to remove from office on this basis, that's not for us to decide. That's an issue for the Senate. And so similarly, in the Trump impeachment proceedings, if someone were to run to the courts on some of these issues, I think we might learn the contours of the political question doctrine in the impeachment context. Imagine if there was a scenario where, say, you know, John Bolton were subpoenaed by the Senate and President Trump asserted executive privilege. Would Chief Justice Roberts decide that? Would the Senate itself decide if they wanted to compel him to appear? And what if President Trump went to the courts to try to get an order to prevent that compulsion order, to challenge it? Would the courts hear that, or would they say, nope, hands off for us, that's a political question? I think President Trump could at least probably get a delay of the impeachment proceedings while the case made its way through the courts. And then ultimately, would they decide, as they did in the case of Walter Nixon, that hands off for us in an impeachment proceeding? Or is this really the only way to break this logjam between the executive and the legislative branch when it comes to an impeachment question? Unknown.
Are you saying that it's not really clear where the benchmark lies to prove unfairness in a Senate proceeding?
That's right. I think that most often when there are these battles between the executive and the legislative branch over issues like privilege or other questions, the two branches go through what's known as the negotiation and accommodation process. They don't want to resort to the courts. They know the courts don't want to answer the questions. And so they work out some sort of compromise. And they agree, well, perhaps we won't produce everything you've asked for, but we'll give you these things that you really need. And the legislature will say, yes, we'll take it and avoid a court battle and we'll move on. President Trump has vowed to, quote, fight all the subpoenas. And when one party stakes out a position like that, the I'm not going to budge, sometimes it does require courts to intervene in that scenario. But if the courts say hands off, we're not going to get involved because it's a political question, then it's not clear how those issues get resolved.
Negotiation and accommodation, two words that have been conspicuously lacking in Washington lately. Does the case to prove unfairness of impeachment proceedings become harder when Republicans hold a Senate majority?
I don't know if it's necessarily because it's Republicans, but I think it's when you have the party of the president, the same party represented in the Senate. And I think one thing that is different, and maybe this is the way it will always be forevermore, it is my observation and my opinion that the Republican majority in the Senate is treating their treatment of President Trump very much in a political manner as opposed to regarding themselves as a separate branch of government that is there to serve as an independent check on a co-equal branch of government. And I think that is something, if you read the Federalist Papers, that is really not envisioned by the framers of the Constitution, that party loyalty would prevail over loyalty to the institution. And I think that's where we are seeing this breakdown in the Senate as an effective check on presidential power.
Do you know the mechanism that would be used to decide that? I mean, if the president's attorneys try to press the issue that the political question is not in force here, and that the judiciary needs to settle the limits of presidential power, I mean, is that something that would have to be discussed in federal court?
Yes. I mean, I think what it would take is actually filing a lawsuit by somebody, whether it is a committee seeking to compel compliance with a subpoena, or if there was a compulsion order issued by Chief Justice Roberts in the impeachment, perhaps a lawsuit brought by President Trump to quash that subpoena and to resist the subpoena. I think that would go to the courts for resolution. And what's interesting is if the courts decided they did not want to get into it, for example, there has been a judge in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals in one of the subpoena matters who has said when a subpoena relates to impeachment, it is a political question that courts cannot decide. Judge Rao on the D.C. Circuit has said that. It was a dissenting opinion. She did not have the majority there. But there does seem to be uncertainty as to whether a court would be willing to decide. Now, if the parties themselves cannot work it out and it's come to that, I don't know that the courts have much choice, because otherwise we are left at a stalemate. And I don't know if that's a satisfactory outcome. Stalemate means that the party who is the non-moving party, I guess, just prevails by default.
Trump's defense, the president's defense team argues that there is no criminal conduct here and that voters are the best arbiters of whether the president's use of power is in the end appropriate. Let's say the Senate votes to acquit, which seems likely, and the president wins a second term in November. Is there anything else that other branches of government could do at that point?
Well, I guess there's always the impeachment power to start over and remove him from office. But I think as a political matter, if the president is not removed from office in this impeachment and then is reelected, it would seem politically difficult to go through another impeachment. I suppose that I would think that Congress will have been weakened if that is the case, because the House did impeach President Trump. And then if the voters were to say, sort of reaffirm his behavior by reelecting him as president, I think what they are saying essentially is that we do not think that the conduct for which he was impeached is sufficient to remove someone from office. I think that sends a message to future presidents that they can engage in similar behavior. You know, one of the reasons prosecutors prosecute criminal cases is to deter that kind of behavior from others in the future. And if President Trump is successful in avoiding removal from office and is successful in being reelected, then I think they have failed in that deterrent effect. And I think that a message has been sent that presidents can get away with this kind of behavior and voters don't care.
Well, is there any reason that the voters should not be the jury? There is an ocean of information available online about what happened during the call to Ukraine. What's wrong with letting the process play out in that manner?
Well, the framers of the Constitution thought otherwise. They thought that removal from office should be done by the House through impeachment and the Senate through removal, rather than waiting for the next election to come around. Certainly, voters have the ability to do that and is to serve as a check even on Congress. But I think one of the arguments that the House managers have made is we can't wait until the next election because President Trump poses a clear and present danger to election security. It is the election itself that is the very subject of the impeachment articles, because President Trump is seeking to undermine the results of that election. And we can't be confident in the results of that election if President Trump is permitted to behave the way that he has. And so there's been this argument that impeachment would effectively be undoing the past election and tearing up the ballots. But under that theory, then no president should ever be impeached. And that's certainly not what the framers of the Constitution intended.
Barb, you mentioned the fact that the appeals court system is still dealing with the question of whether Don McGahn should obey a subpoena and the challenge to executive privilege that case represents. The House proceedings are over with. Do you think that case is going to be resolved before the Senate comes to the end of its process? Will it be a moot point?
I don't think it's going to be resolved before the Senate comes to the end of its process here. I don't know that it means it's a moot point, because the president could always be impeached for other behavior. The McGahn information really goes to the obstruction of justice allegations that arise from Robert Mueller's report. Don McGahn is listed many, many times in the Mueller report because he was interviewed, and the House wants an opportunity to question him about some of those same matters. So it would really be a different impeachment inquiry, I think. I think they could open it again as a matter of law. Now, I suppose as a matter of politics, it would be difficult to successfully have another impeachment inquiry without getting a lot of blowback, I think, from the public. If they're not successful in this effort, I think that there would be some fatigue among the public and probably even members of the House itself.
You note in your article that there's really a hybrid of legal and political procedures in play here for which we're off the map. There's no playbook. What are we to make of this? How is it that we've found ourselves in this place where there is no set of guidance for what is going on?
I think we find ourselves here because President Trump is such a buster of norms. He's a disruptor. He has behaved very differently from other presidents in the past. I think, as we discussed earlier, whereas most members of the executive branch in prior administrations have been willing to participate in the negotiation and accommodation process, for example, President Trump says, I will fight all the subpoenas. He's a fighter. He's a counterpuncher. He's a disruptor. And so I think that failure to follow norms means that if it is not written into the law, we can't count on him to go along with the status quo or the way things have done in the past. I think it will cause us to reexamine some of the ways that we do things in government. Do we need to enshrine into law some of the things that were always just our assumptions and make them laws? But, you know, at the end of the day, it's sort of when I was U.S. attorney, one of the things that was often said is the way to avoid personnel problems and management problems is to hire good people. And I think that voters would be wise to take that advice, that the way to avoid problems in management of our government is to elect good presidents. And if you have a disruptor, it's not all bad. The presidency has evolved in prior generations by people who have thought and acted outside the box. And change certainly is sometimes a very good thing. But when you have people willing to flout the law and to disrespect co-equal branches of government, I do think that voters should think twice about whether that's the kind of person who is wielding power responsibly.
Can you give us a sense of how judges and legal scholars navigate these situations where there truly is no hard and fast guidance?
It's difficult when, you know, typically what courts and lawyers do is they look for precedent. Are there prior court cases on the same issue that we can look to and say this case is either like that prior case or it's different in an important way? And that's a way to navigate the space. Or is there a statute that governs this situation? And you look to those things. In the absence of those things, then it's a lot more difficult. And you have to look to what are our values and expectations, looking at things like the Federalist Papers. You know, that's something that I think many of us hadn't thought about since our days studying constitutional law. But you'll see a lot of references to Federalist Number 65 and what Alexander Hamilton wrote. And so I think getting back to the core values of our democracy are the things that I look to. We care in this country about separation of powers. We care in this country about democracy. We care about transparency in government. And so looking to all of those things, how do you reconcile those values with what we're doing and where we want to go as a country?
It's so difficult when one of your pieces of contemporary case law regards Andrew Johnson. Well, thank you for taking a few minutes to talk with us about this. And
you bet.
We'll have a link to the article up online. We
Great.
Appreciate your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Professor Barb McQuaid with the University of Michigan Law School. For another take on questions of executive privilege, come back for tomorrow's show. We'll be talking with the attorney who helped win exoneration for a Japanese-American civil rights pioneer who challenged his internment during World War II. That's it for today's show. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.